If you have your Bibles, please take them and turn with me to the book of Kings, chapter 17, once again. If you have been in our service the last couple of weeks, then you know that we are we've commenced a study on the life and ministry of Elijah. And after a lot of going back and forth, I finally gave in to the urge to preach this series under the general heading, What God Can Do Through Ordinary You. And the reason I had some pause and some hesitation is I'm familiar with that term, or have been familiar with it for a long time, and it's been used, I think the first time I heard it was in connection to the life of Gideon, and certainly it would apply. You could actually build a series under that by using various Bible characters that were really ordinary, even the entire disciples were not men of prominence. So God can do things through ordinary you. And so I said, well, though it is not original with me, not the title, it just seems to fit beautifully to Elijah. Because in our first sermon, what we remembered is Elijah was a man. James tells us that Elijah was a man. You can understand why he would say that, because quite frankly, when you look at his accomplishments, you may think he was a supernatural man. He did things that there were no human explanation for them. He was able, as I said, he outruns a chariot of horses on foot. He sees a dead boy come to life. He's fed by angels. He's parts the Jordan River. He actually does 16 different miracles. You remember his protege or his understudy, Elisha, refused to leave his side because he sensed that Elijah was going to be leaving the earth. And Elisha says to Elijah, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be here to the end. What can I do for you, Elisha? He says, well, I just want a double portion of your spirit to fall on me. And about that time, heaven calls for Elijah, and the chariots are coming to get him, and he's caught up in the chariots, but he drops his mantle and throws it on Elisha. And whereas Elijah did 16 miracles, the scriptures record 32 miracles under the ministry of Elisha. A double portion of his spirit fell on the young man by simply being robed in his mantle. This man was a man of God, called from an ordinary life, but he did extraordinary things. He's a paradox in many ways. Elijah, at times you'll see him fearless. At other times in our study, we will notice that he can be very fearful. Sometimes Elijah appears very humble. Then there are other times when you see his ego, almost to the point of egocentric. At least it seems that way. Elijah was a man, a different man, a special man, but just a man at his best. I read this past week, or maybe it was a couple of weeks ago, where one commentator described Elijah as living life in the minor key. I like that, because that's how I perceive him. I don't see him laughing a lot, whistling Dixie. You know, he's a prophet, and he is delivering a very unpopular message. The populace does not like it, and they're going to feel the pinch of his message too, because they're not going to repent, and so God's going to bring this terrible drought on the land, and many people are going to die. And Elijah is the one that it's all ascribed to as troubling Israel, causing all these problems. And so he lives life, as the pastor said, in the minor key. The minor key is sometimes used to describe some very interesting things, very substantive thoughts, but yet it takes us into a little darker side, a little bit eerie, the minor key. Elijah I agree. He lives life in the minor key. Now, the first sermon, Elijah was a man. Last week, I spoke to you about now what, and we won't review that for the sake of those of you that were here. See, I'm going to show appreciation to you. And you know, I want to tell everybody that wasn't here how, you know, all about it, but I'm going to be gracious to those of you that endured it the first time. My subject today is the commotion of emotions. The commotion of emotions. Now, what do I mean by emotions? You know, we're all, God made us all with emotion. I mean, the soul is the seat of our emotions. It is from your soul that you love, that you laugh, that you get angry, you can get sad. The soul, as it is the core, it is the energy core of your life. And so we all have emotions. It is designed that way by our Creator. Our emotions serve us. For example, even when there's fear, I believe that sometimes is a way of alarming us or concerning us, causing us to back off in some situation. Fear is, it's a servant to us. Laughter serves us. A merry heart's good like a medicine, the Bible tells us. Sometimes sadness serves us because Jesus said, "Blessed are they that mourn, they shall be comforted." And so in terms of just your natural emotions that God gives you, they are your servant. They serve you to help lead you, guide you, and direct you to be the best you can be. But it's different than emotion is not like being emotional. Now, we all have emotions, but we shouldn't all be emotional all the time. Emotions serve us, but when we become emotional, then we become a slave to those emotions. They're no longer there to serve us. We're actually serving them. We become the servant of fear, and we can't break away. We just live in fear. We become the servant of anger, and we can't break through. We just live mad. Become the servant of misery. We can't break through. We've just become a miserable person. So emotion, God-given thing. But to live an emotional life goes outside of the parameters of Scripture, and it cannot be reconciled with a person who's indeed living by faith. So what happens when a person trades emotions for an emotional life? They will always create commotion. They're always an instrument that disrupts, brings discord, confusion, and the like. As a matter of fact, the word emotion, it actually means a person that creates an uproar. Have a lot of, the dictionary actually said hullabaloo. It's just hysteria. We all know people like that. And if we were honest, we try to avoid them, don't we? I don't like bumping into hysterical people. Because I feel like I'm on the verge of it half the time myself. And just any little thing may push me over the edge. I need to be around somebody stable, somebody that can think rational when I'm on the cliff. And so the commotion of emotion. Now, with those thoughts in mind, I want to read to you again, and we read this passage, but I want to pick up, I can't say where we left off because I did include this part into our study, but I only made reference to it really. But I want to look at this part of the text today, 1 Kings 17, 17 through 30. And I want you to focus on the two primary characters in this passage. You have this widow woman of Zarephath, wonderful lady. And you have the prophet Elijah. Now both find themselves in a very emotional situation. Matter of fact, Elijah has been kind of going through a lot of emotional things, or he's been dealing with his emotions for some time. For example, the Bible doesn't say this, but I can only imagine the temptation to be afraid the first day he stood in front of Ahab. But he mastered his fear and did not become emotional. See, when you're emotional, the dictionary said that means you're overly whatever. If you're sensitive, it's okay to be sensitive, but overly sensitive people. It's a good thing to be focused, but it's overly focused. That's called fixated and obsession and so forth. So it's the overdoing of whatever it is. So Elijah's just a man, so perhaps he was a bit fearful and had to manage that fear. And he didn't become emotional. He managed his fear and he delivered the message. But when he left Ahab, his orders were now to go hide himself by the brook Kerith. Now, he might have, I don't know this, but it's possible that he may have experienced some confusion. Because he's thinking, why do I have to hide, man? I'm the most powerful man in the world. I have the ear of God. And God said I could call the rain when I was ready for the rain, and I could stop it now. And so that's a pretty, you know, you talk about the whole armor of God, that's pretty strong. Hide myself? What Elijah may not have known is that this drought would affect him too. He would also be a victim of the nation's apostasy. Not that he himself had apostatized, but because the culture had sunk so far away from God, he was going to get thirsty too, and water would be scarce. He would get hungry too, and food would be scarce. You see, sometimes the further our nation goes away from God, we all become the victims of the culture, and we have to we become a part of the chastening of God, because this is who we are and this is where we are. So here he is now, and he's been to the brook, and he's and as he moves on, all the experiences that I've already talked about, each time I'm sure he was met with a certain emotion, but he was able to master that and handle it beautifully, and there was no commotion ever. There's no commotion by the brook. There's no commotion with the birds, even though they were dirty birds. He makes no complaint to God. He goes to the widow of Zarephath's house, the barrel of meal. Says, meal, food. Oh, boy, he looks in there. It's empty. He creates no commotion. And all of the things that had taken place in his life, I know he had emotion, but there was no commotion because he was able to master that and handle that and trust God. But now he is fixing to face the biggest test of his faith to date. Not just the little boy is going to die, but his dear, dear friend is going to question his integrity. And when you read her comments, it is almost as if she's turning on him. Now, nothing sticks like that, does it? And so let's pick it up and think about it from that standpoint. It came to pass after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, fell sick. And his sickness was so sore that there was no breath left in him. And she said unto Elijah, now this is, you know, it's a time for emotion. There's pain, that's grief. But remember I said emotional is to be controlled by that grief now, and that grief makes us overly whatever. In her mind here, she's completely irrational in her statement. What have I to do with thee, O thou man of God? Art thou coming to me to call my sin to remembrance and to slay my son? Now, that is absolutely 100% an emotional response. There's nothing in Elijah's life that would make her think that he would ever do those things. Kill your son? Throw your sin in your face? He'd never acted that way before. But now the crisis has gotten so bad in her life personally, and her heart is full of so much grief, she begins to become hysterical and so emotional that she says all of these things. She's not unlike Mary and Martha in the New Testament when Jesus comes to town, and by their calendar, he's 3 days late. And they just get in his face, I mean our Lord, and say, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And you know what Jesus did? He wept. He wept. Now, why did Jesus wept? Because he showed up late and the brother didn't die? No, he wept because they could not trust him, even when they didn't understand him. That's why he cried. You really think the resurrection and the life cried because Lazarus died? Are you kidding me? He owns everything in heaven and earth and even in hell. He owns it. The Bible didn't say he had the keys to heaven, death, hell, and the grave. That's ownership. Matter of fact, Jesus looked at that cemetery and said, Lazarus, come forth. If he hadn't said, Lazarus, come forth, every dead person there would have gotten up. Don't tell me he was weeping. I hear preachers say, you know, Jesus even cried when his friend died. I understand I'm a pastor, and sometimes we really reach for words that may be a comfort, but that's not why Jesus cried. These are his dear, dear friends, and they can't trust him in a dark time, in a bad time. She's just like that. You, who are you? I thought I knew you. Now look what you've done. Now, I'm going to prove to you that Elijah was going through a lot of things internally himself. But he reminds me of the duck on the pond. You know, that duck sits up there, head up, and he just floats, and the water doesn't even ripple. But he is battling his heart out down below. Elijah is smooth, and he masters his emotions, and I'll prove to you that he has some of the same emotions that she's feeling, but he doesn't get emotional, and therefore there's no real commotion, and things get done. He said unto her, give me thy son. And he took him out of her bosom and carried him up into the loft where he abode, and he laid him upon his own bed. Now, watch him. Watch him as he talks to the Lord about what's going on in his heart. He cried unto the Lord and said, O Lord my God, hast thou also brought evil upon the widow whom I sojourned by slaying her son? He's wrestling now with a natural emotion where we begin to doubt. Did I do the right thing? Perhaps this woman is right. Am I the cause of this? So he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried unto the Lord and said, O Lord my God, I pray thee, let this child's soul come into him again. And the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. Elijah took the child and brought him down out of the chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, see, thy son liveth. If he'd have been one of today's preachers, he'd say, now how dare you, woman, talking to me like that? You see how wrong you were? He didn't. He said, see, your son's okay. And the woman said to Elijah, now, by this I know that thou art a man of God. Now, she should have already known that, because Elijah's presence in her home allowed that meal, you know, the bread and the oil and all, to sustain them for many, many days through that drought and keep her safe. She should have already known it. But now this crisis was bigger than Elijah in her mind. It was outside of his skill set, and he was probably the cause of it. So she just chunked everything that had been done for her in the past. She doesn't judge him on his whole body of work with her. She judges him over this incident because she's emotional. And she creates a real uproar. But now she's decided that he is indeed the man of God. People like this, I believe, that when the next crisis comes around, they can revert to the same thing if they don't understand what really happened in the middle of this crisis. It's you, dear lady, that couldn't trust God. It was never anyone else's fault. And so, now let me just say this. When I read this, I think about our country right now. We're the United States of America. Or we have been. But doesn't it feel like the divided states of America? That People that have very strong beliefs on one thing, and there's nothing wrong with that. One of the great things about our country is that if you don't like something that's going on, you can vote, or you can make a peaceful protest, or you can write your senators or Congress. You know, you can do those things. That's democracy, and that's a blessing. But what we have taking place in our country now is where you have people that believe this over here and people believe that over there. And what's happened is there's no civil discourse, but there are death threats. There are some of those profane things coming out of the mouths of those that are supposed to be superior in terms of intellect than most of us in this room. But they talk horrible. It's amazing. As you know, the judge is going to be voted on here in a few days. You got a group over here that says, hey, he's a good man. You got an accuser over here that says, hey, he did this to me. And so what happens is the family of the accused, excuse me, is getting death threats and getting cursed out. The accuser is getting death threats and getting cursed out. It's okay to have your opinion, whatever your opinion is about what it is. It's okay for you to like or dislike the nominee and all of that. But my point is the commotion is a result of being emotional and not rational. That's why irrational things get said. And that's to whatever your opinion is. That's just an example of what's in our country. But, you know, this happens in our homes and in our churches and our lives all the time. I want to show you how what happens to you. You might be here today. Excuse me. I was hoping I wouldn't start my cough. I've had it for a few days now. When you're at emotional crossroads in your life, maybe some of you are going through that. Your emotions have been pulled and pulled and pulled, and you are absolutely on the verge of becoming emotional. I want to warn you that if you operate emotionally, you're going to create commotion. I tell people all the time, sometimes young couples will come to the office, they want to get married. I says, okay, how long have you been with this person? They say, well, I've been with them X number of times. I says, have y'all really gotten mad yet? No, we never get mad. Well, let's don't get married yet, you know. Let's wait till y'all have a big fight. Because that way we can see how you handle this person's anger or that person's anger. Have y'all ever just had your heart broken by one another? Ever been disappointed by the other one? No, he just perfect. You know, she just perfect. And I'm saying, listen, y'all don't have to say all this stuff to me. I mean, I'm a real person here. I'm a guy whose wife told him, yeah, Frank, I want to get married. You perfect. Yeah. It's been a long time since I've ever heard that. So I'm trying to help people, you understand? And so I said, look, you ever been disappointed by this person? Oh, no, that one. Well, stay around long enough and see how disappointed you get. And so mad, sad, glad even can be dangerous, overly glad. We're talking about emotional. I know people that get all hyped up sometimes and go out and buy things they can't afford and they're in all kind of debt and it creates all kind of stress later. And so what I'm saying is this is serious, you know, and so you come to emotional crossroads in your life. Yes, you've got emotions, but if you cave in and become emotional in making major decisions in your life, you're going to create a commotion. You're going to mess up. You're going to do something you shouldn't have done that you're going to regret later. Now, what I want to do in looking at the woman here is talk about the commotion of unrestrained emotion, okay? Here's the commotion that's created by unrestrained emotion. She, number one, her response lacks faith. You know, this woman, her faith should have been growing while she was there. She didn't have anything in that barrel except enough to make one biscuit. And she made that, and she looked back in the barrel, and there's enough to make one for her son, one for her. And the next day, she was able to look back, and there's enough to make one for Elijah, her son. And this went on for many, many days. Every day, she's scraping the bottom of the barrel, and God shows up on time and always feeds them and sustains them. But now when a problem bigger than anything she's ever experienced, or the closest thing to her heart gets touched, she reveals that her faith really hasn't grown during times of blessing. It just usually doesn't happen like that. Faith's like a muscle. It grows in times of resistance. You know, if you go to the gym, you put some weight there that makes it difficult for you to resist, and you resist that weight, and muscles grow. Faith grows in times of resistance if you apply it to the truths of God's Word. Faith doesn't usually grow in times of blessing. That's why the children of Israel could be blessed every single day, and every time something happened in the negative, they complained. So her response exposes an obvious lack of faith. And now watch the emotions that touch her life. She, first of all, deals with some anger. Verse 18 says this, there's anger. What have I to do with thee? Elijah, what have I to do with thee? It's almost like she's saying, I wish I'd have never even met you. Well, you'd have died a long time ago if you hadn't have. But she's mad. And now she's emotional. And now commotion's created, and she's saying something that she will, of course, regret later. And that's what happens to every one of us. When we become emotional, we create commotion, and we say a lot more than we should say. What have I to do with thee? That's anger. Sarcasm gets involved. Oh, thou man of God. I don't think she was saying that in a reverential way. I wouldn't see you saying, now Reverend Elijah, what have I to do with thee? Oh, you're a man of God. Sarcasm. Well, not only sarcasm, but something's secretly hiding in her life. Not unlike most of us. Everybody's got baggage. Everybody's got skeletons in their closet. And guess what? Here comes to the surface haunting guilt. She's angry. She's sarcastic. And now, in her tears, she says, art thou come unto me to call my sin to remembrance? You know what's interesting about this passage? She's the only one that mentions her sin. I have no doubt in my mind that whatever her sin was, this woman had already repented of it. Because Jesus said in the book of Mark, I believe it is, he said there were many widows in Israel, but only to one of them was Elijah sent, and that was to the woman in Zarephath. She was chosen of God. God had dealt with that. God had chosen her. God had blessed her. God had made her a part of his family. But she is haunted by the guilt of some sin. And when you are an emotional person and you can't master that emotion, then what happens is things like anger. Anger's natural, but now it's over the top, and you're irrational, and you've got sarcasm mixed in with that. And now you want to blame someone else for bringing your sin to your remembrance. I've had people come to say to me, you know, Frank, you were preaching that right to me. And I'm going to say this right now, and as God is my witness. Now, am I aware sometimes that when I'm preaching that people have gone through certain experiences? Of course I am. But I do not get in the pulpit to face people personally. In my mind, that's a coward. I will never come to the pulpit with the intent to personally attack you. That's a coward. If I have a situation that I need to talk to you about, you have my word. It'll be in private. Now, I can't help if some of the messages get to meddling in your emotions. But I'm in no way, I wouldn't do it. Matter of fact, sometimes I'm silent about some things that I probably should say more about, but it doesn't seem appropriate given maybe some conversations or talks or some counseling that we've had. So that none of that's true. But that's how people always feel. Or have you come to call my sin to remembrance? I had dealt with it. She is so far off base. She's emotional. Hysterical. You don't believe she's hysterical? She won't know if you come to murder my boy. Did you see that last one there? And to slay my son. That's how irrational and ridiculous she sounds. But see, when you're an emotional crossroad, yeah, we've all got emotions, okay? Now you've got this crisis or this thing going on in your life, and so now you've got this temptation to become what? You know, bring your emotions under the government of God and allow God to lead you and guide you even when you feel like your world's falling apart. You can do that, or you can just, you know, kind of cave in to all that you're feeling and become emotional and create all kind of commotion, and you're going to feel, do, and say a lot of irrational things. And so that's why you don't want to do it. Now, the second thing, that's how she reacts, and it reveals a response. Her response reveals a lack of faith. But look how relationships get fractured during times like this. And I want to move through this very, very quickly and not even use verses here. But I read this last week about relationships, and I thought it was good enough to share. When we meet one another or people in the world in which we live, three things happen before we become in a relationship. I'm talking about friendships or, you know, people that, you know, enjoy the company of one another, or whatever. I'm not necessarily talking about anything romantic or anything of that sort. I'm talking about friendships primarily. Well, you know, maybe it's business or church relationships, you own your job or whatever. Three things happen, okay? When it's positive, we have to remember about veneer. The author said veneer. What is veneer? That's something that is put over the surface of something to hide something that is unsightly on the other side. We've heard of brick veneer homes. In other words, like that home's been a framed rickety old house forever. Now they just come in there and put some brick around. It's veneer. It's hiding something that's on the other side. We meet people and we think, man, that's Mr. Wonderful. That's Miss Wonderful. Man, this person's awesome. They're great, whatever. Well, there's always some veneer because none of us are perfect. So what happens is when it's just veneer, there's disillusion. Now, what do you mean by disillusion? Well, that's when you become disappointed with the person. In other words, you find out, hey, that's veneer. You know, I thought you were my friend. I thought you were going to help me. I thought you were here for me. I thought this, that, and the other. But disillusion is when we realize that the person that we thought, or the job that we thought, or the church that we thought was just the perfect place for us, has proven to have this veneer. And that's a surface thing. And something that has been noticed that's where you've seen fault or whatever has created some disappointment, some disillusionment. Okay? We've all experienced that. That's why you ought to be very careful about committing to a friend. I told a friend this week, I said, you know, I don't commit to a lot of friendships. Now, I have a lot of acquaintances and people I care a great deal about. But one reason I don't commit to this being, hey, this is a friendship for life or whatever kind of, what is that, BFFs, you know, best friend, isn't that right, BFF? I'm not really into the BFF thing so much, you know. Because the Bible said that a man that has friends must show himself friendly. Now, you think that means shake a lot of people's hands, kiss a lot of babies, be a lot of fun. No, what it's saying, it's actually a careful warning. It's a caution. If you are going to have a friend, be a friend. And that means be friendly. Make the same investment in that friend's life that they're making in yours. And so when you go through the veneer and then you get disappointed and then there's disillusion, you see, relationships are fractured. Now here, hang on with me. The third thing is reality. Now, when you're not living according to just absolute emotions all the time, you understand reality. I remember years ago when I first got in the ministry and I was very, very young, I ran with a circle of preachers that I thought were just, they were Moses and Elijah, in my opinion, Peter and Paul and James and John. I mean, I had absolute, just they were heroes. They were what I always wanted to be in many ways. But the more I got to know them, I became disillusioned. I saw things, heard things that disappointed me. But at this point, you decide, okay, look, what kind of friendship can I maintain with this person? But here's what I realized when I got a little older. That was all my fault. None of those preachers claimed to be any of those things I thought they were. None of them said that they were like Peter and Paul and James and John and Moses and Elijah. None of them said that. That was my disillusion. So I had to face reality, and the reality was, look, we're all just human on our best day. None of us are perfect. And the older I got, I found out how imperfect I am. But you know, I related that to myself this week when I was thinking that. I know there has to be people along the way that I have disappointed a great deal. They first met me, and later their disillusionment made them think that, hey, it was only a veneer. I would just like to ask you if indeed that's the case. First of all, I don't want to disappoint you, but I don't think I ever claimed to be a whole lot. Reality keeps us from being overly emotional. You see, the commotion of unrestrained emotion, there's a lack of faith. It's dangerous. It exposes a lack of faith. But then relationships get fractured. And then a third thing, and I'm going to be through in just a moment, but I got to get to Elijah, but I'll just give it to you real quick. Here's the thing about your crisis and your trials, okay? The things that you're so hysterical about, or you're so obsessed about, or you're so fixated about. I had a husband tell me this week, said, you know, you just have no idea what I'm living in. He said, every day, all day long, my wife sits around and she's watching Dr. Phil and everybody else. And when I come home, I'm so tired, and she's trying to tell me how she's trying to fix me. And I'm just beat to the socks. And she wants me to watch this clip from Dr. Phil and watch this over here. Well, how's that working for you? He said, I hate it. He said, I'm sick of it. I said, I'd hate it too. And said, I don't know why I'm going through this. The reasons for a lot of things we go through, here's what's amazing. You know, the old song, you'll understand it better by and by. You may or you may not. Some reasons for some crises are never fully known to us. You see, here's what happens when we're emotional. We demand all the answers. Read the Psalms. I mean, man, some of those guys in the Psalms, they're really telling God, he better get down here right now and give him some answers. And I hear people like that, you know, I watch them, you know, when they're going through a hard time and stuff like that, some of the things they say, you know. And I wish I had time to relate a couple of them, but I'm moving on. And I had a preacher say one time, he said, you know how to stay at your church as long as you want to stay? He said, learn to preach in 35 minutes and shut up in 40. He said, you can stay as long as you want. And every week, I cut back, cut back, cut back, cut back, cut back. Y'all quit clapping. That's rude. Man, that's the rudest thing I ever. But now here I am at 38 minutes and 54 seconds, and I hadn't even gotten to Elijah yet. Now see my problem. We better move on. I got to give you this, though. Notice how emotions that are controlled by unrivaled devotion. It's like Elijah's feeling all these things, but he's got his blinders on. You see, she runs to the panic room, he runs to the prayer room. You know, her emotions, she just vents, and she has no filter. She just says whatever. And most people like that are proud of it. You know, I'm just going to say what I think. Well, what you think may not be right. Elijah is feeling a lot of the same things, and he has a lot of the same questions. But here is a man whose emotion drives him to God, and he avoids commotion. Look how he reacts. First thing he does is he disconnects from the crazy woman. He disconnects from the commotion. Give me the child. You know, see, he wouldn't have said that, crazy woman, but I did. So, and he took him out of her bosom. Man, hand me the baby now. Talking about somebody killing folks and all the things you're saying. Now, give me the little fella. And I would say that that's one first thing that any of us should do is when you are face to face with hysteria, be kind and gentle, but get away. Disconnect, because it'll wear on you and it'll make you, you bite into that. So get alone. The second thing, he displays his emotion, but he shows us that there's no commotion in his plan. When he takes this baby, okay, what does he do? He carries him up into the loft. And I like it. Look how sweet this is. Where he abode, and he laid him upon his own bed. Here's a man who's showing that his temper is completely under control. He's not mad at the woman who has said these things about him. He's not defending himself. He's hurting. He gets the child, gets alone, and he does this big, strong, brave man cried unto the Lord. I love that. But he tells us here that he has the same problem she's having. Really, he's just handling it different. Oh, Lord, my God, hast thou also brought evil upon the widow with whom I sojourn? Lord, God, I know I prayed for no rain for 3.5 years, and I knew people were going to die, but I thought this house was protected. God could have said, the whole nation is under chastening, and some people are just victim of other people's sins. But Lord, you got to help me here. What's going on? He displays emotion but creates no commotion. And he has unrivaled devotion. This is what I love. I think my favorite thing. He cries unto the Lord. He says, oh Lord, my God. And he puts it out there. And you know what? God does not tell him why that child died. God gave him no answer to the thing that was really bothering him. Did you do this? Did I do this? Did that mean, is this all because of my prayer that I pray? I mean, God doesn't give him the answers to the why. But you know what he does? He gives him an answer to his prayer. So Elijah lays on the boy, and he breathes, and he prays 3 times, and God puts the soul of the child back in him, and the boy wakes up, and he takes him. I want to ask you a question, and we're going to close. I got one more point, and I'm closed. Keith, come on. Watch this. I want to ask you something. If you're at an emotional crossroads, you're demanding answers. You've got to know why this. You need to know this. You need to know that. Here's a question for you. Had you rather God answer your questions or answer your prayer? God doesn't have to tell you anything. as to why he lets things happen. He's God. I see these bumper stickers. God is my co-pilot. And I'm thinking, how ridiculous. I mean, are you kidding me? He's your co-pilot? I mean, look, you're not even in the room where the decisions are being made, much less co-pilot. I mean, so you're the pilot and he's co-pilot. Man, you're flying coach. I'm telling you, I don't care what your name is. You're flying coach, and you're going wherever that plane's taking you, and the sovereign God is the pilot. And he doesn't have a co-pilot. Doesn't need one. He never slumbers or sleeps. Somebody wrote the sweetest little email the other day, very young Christian, and bless her heart, she's had some emotional problems. I mean, some mental sickness, and she was talking about how she prays for this and prays for that. She said, and just the other day I told God, I know, Lord, you need some sleep too, and you're so tired. And it was sweet, though. I mean, because but you know, aren't you glad he doesn't? Never slumbers, never sleeps. We're all flying coach. And we've got a pilot that never fails. Avoid the commotion of being emotional. And see what God can do through ordinary you when you just let that crisis drive you to God instead of away from Him.